Hello. At its high point in the 7th and 8th centuries AD, Tang China was a geographically vast empire consisting of maybe 50 or 60 million subjects. And this period is also commonly regarded as one of the cultural pinnacles of Chinese civilization. In the opening lecture of this course, I stressed how cities and civilization have tended to go together. So, it's not surprising to learn that one of the characteristics of the Tang Empire was that it possessed an unusual number of large cities. Intensive urbanization was a Tang phenomenon. Several of its cities had over 100,000 occupants. And in the 8th century AD, the Tang capital of Chang'an, which is modern Xi'an, was probably the largest city in the world, with a population that may even have approached 1 million people. Like Rome before it, it was also a highly cosmopolitan, cultured, diverse place that drew artists, merchants, students, and pilgrims from all corners of Asia. And in this bustling metropolis could be found the most sophisticated examples of contemporary culture, as well as the most advanced technological innovations, and a flourishing of the arts, ranging from everything from poetry to ceramics. So, in this lecture, I will examine some of the more famous and impressive aspects of Tang urban civilization. Imagine yourself entering the capital city of Chang'an around, say, 740 AD. What might you see? Well, the city encompassed about 30 square miles, and it was surrounded by a strong wall made of packed earth, and this wall was pierced by 12 gates. Each of the gates was timber-framed and lined with brick. And taking up a lot of the northernmost quadrant of Chang'an was a huge walled complex, somewhat like a city within the city. And this was the imperial palace, or I should say a sequence of three imperial palaces, and in addition another zone, which was called the imperial city. The three palaces were the home of the emperor and his court, and the imperial city housed the offices of government and of its administrators. Separating the palaces from the imperial city was an open courtyard, and this served as a setting for certain important religious rituals which were performed personally by the emperor. Now, if you were just an ordinary resident of the capital city, you would never set foot within those two very heavily guarded precincts. And in fact, they were separated from the rest of the city by their own 33-foot-high wall. If you even climbed to a rooftop from which you could look down over that wall into the imperial regions, that was an offense which could carry a penalty of incarceration for 1 year. While the imperial palace and the imperial city were strictly off limits to ordinary people, the remainder of Chang'an was accessible, and it was given over to commercial, residential, and religious structures. So, just inside the main eastern and western gates, you would find two great marketplaces where goods ranging from just staples to the most exotic luxuries could be bought and sold. And within each market, the stalls were organized or grouped into those selling the same or similar items. So, for example, all the goldsmiths would be together, as would be all the butchers, the apothecaries, the fishmongers, the blacksmiths, the potters, the weavers, and so on. This city formed the eastern terminus of the Silk Road. And so in it, you would find trade goods from all over the world. And these were brought by never-ending streams of caravans and wagons and barges. All sorts of people, Arabs, Indians, Jews, Turks, Japanese, Tibetans, Cambodians, Vietnamese, and all sorts of other ethnic groups and nationalities could all be found mingled together in the markets, hawking their goods. The southern sections of the city were a series of residential neighborhoods or wards, which were laid out on grid patterns. And each individual ward was surrounded by its own little earthen wall, maybe just 9 or 10 feet high. And so the troops who were in charge of patrolling these ward areas could just close the gates to them, and by doing so, closely monitor traffic in and out of each district. At sunrise and sunset, big drums were beaten as an announcement that the gates were being opened or closed. And so those booming rhythms would have marked the start and end of the business day for many of the city's inhabitants. The main streets, which led to each of the major city gates, were also laid out on nice, convenient grid patterns. And the very largest of these streets, which was called the Avenue of the Vermilion Bird, was over 300 feet wide. And it also served as the boundary between the eastern and western halves of the city itself. In the wards surrounding the eastern market, you could find a number of schools where hopeful students would be feverishly studying to take the civil service examinations, and each of them would be dreaming that that could be their stepping stone to eventual wealth and power in the administration. Also in that district tended to cluster restaurants, inns, taverns, and brothels. And the erotic entertainment could range in price and offerings from very high-status establishments where the women would be accomplished musicians, singers, and hostesses, somewhat similar to Japanese geishas, to just more ordinary prostitutes roaming around in the streets. And many of the patrons of those establishments were the very same young men who were studying for the exams, so that juxtaposition was natural. There are many stories and songs that are set among this district with all its lively social interactions. And a typical one tells the story of a promising young scholar who has been sent to the big city by his father. And his father, of course, cherishes hopes that his son will shine in the exams and so bring fortune to the entire family. The boy, however, when he gets there, becomes infatuated with a local prostitute. And so he squanders all his money and neglects his studies. Discovering what his son had been up to, the father beats him savagely and leaves him for dead in the very same garden where traditionally successful exam candidates would celebrate their academic triumphs. And lying there half dead in that garden, the very same prostitute that he had fallen in love with found him, and she then repents that she had led him astray. So she takes him in, she nurses him back to health, and then helps him study for the exams. And eventually, he goes on not only to pass the exams, but to achieve the sort of distinction that his father had dreamt of all along. And so this is a nice story. It ends happily with the father and son reconciled, and even a marriage between the promising young scholar and the now former prostitute. Other prominent structures found in the city had to do with religion. So there were religious schools, religious institutions, and of course, temples and shrines, which could be found all throughout the city. One Japanese visitor reported that he had found no fewer than 300 Buddhist temples in the capital, and an especially large Buddhist monastery occupied almost the entire southwest corner of the city. All of those Buddhist buildings were balanced by at least 36 major Taoist sites as well. And in keeping with the cosmopolitan nature of the city, there were lots of other temples serving the adherents of many other religions, including Zoroastrianism, Manichaeism, Nestorian Christianity, and of course Islam. Cities such as Chang'an served as points of stimulus for the entire economy. And an increase in China's agricultural and industrial production, including iron casting, silk processing, porcelain manufacture, and the newly invented craft of papermaking, all stimulated a brisk trade, which tended to flow along the Grand Canal. It also came overland across the Silk Road and across the ocean by sea throughout Southeast Asia. Various southern port cities flourished because of this sea trade. And the trade by sea was also encouraged by the fact that porcelain didn't transport very well in those bumpy camel caravans going across land. All of this trade activity probably led to the development of one of Tang civilization's most characteristic traits, and that is a general openness to other cultures. The Tang are often considered among the most outward-looking of all the Chinese dynasties. So in the Tang capital cities and at the imperial court, there was a taste for exotic, foreign, or unusual things. Other nations would send tribute to the Tang court, including various animals that were not found in China. So there are painted scrolls that show emissaries, for example, bringing a lion and an ibex on a little leash as gifts. Various Tang ceramic figurines, which are very attractively glazed in shades of brown, orange, yellow, and green, will show barbarian handlers leading camels, which are heavily burdened with trade goods, and sometimes even carrying an entire troupe of musicians. And this is not very surprising, because foreign music and musicians became very popular in the Tang era. These little clay figurines, which are a common find in people's tombs, suggest just how eagerly the Tang anticipated the arrival of various caravans from Central Asia, each of which might bring some new, exciting, and unfamiliar item. One especially popular imported product, which came from Southeast Asia, was tea. And tea was originally used mainly for medicinal purposes, but tea was able to be grown widely enough that it became available everywhere, and so it ultimately turned into China's national drink, and tea houses proliferated. Another interesting new item was the chair, which likely originated in the Middle East. And over a couple centuries, it gradually took over from seating pads so that the Chinese became the only ancient East Asian people to sit in chairs. Chinese music and art also absorbed foreign influences. And in the early 7th century AD, there was a kind of craze for foreign fashions among Chinese women. These sorts of climates often produce fads for certain specific luxury goods. And two of the most famous Tang obsessions were for exotic horses and flowers. Specially bred imported horses from the north and the western regions were especially prized. Emperor Xuanzang had over 40,000 horses in his imperial stables. And he even had little paintings made of his favorites. In fact, there were artists who specialized in doing nothing else but horse portraits, which were intended to capture not just the physical appearance of the horse, but something of its spirit or character as well. And the different types of horses were given very poetic-sounding names. For example, some were called Flying Yellow, or Night Lightning, Drifting Cloud, and Five Blossom. One very charming stone relief depicts an imperial horse whose name is Autumn Dew being lovingly tended to by his groom. Maybe the most extreme manifestation of this whole horse obsession was the famous dancing horses of the Emperor Xuanzang. He had a special band of 100 highly trained dance horses. And they would come out dressed in finely embroidered cloth. Their harnesses were made out of precious metals, gold and silver. And their manes would have pearls and jade ornaments woven into them. A group of musicians would play a tune, which was called the Upturned Cup. It was about drinking. And in perfect coordination with the rhythm, the horses would shake their heads, flick their tails, prance in unison, and at one point even climb up a 3-level platform. One court official wrote some poems commemorating these trained horses' amazing skills. And let me read you a sample of this. The poem goes, "Heavenly horses have come for the ceremony from far west of the sea. They stride slowly with their feet arched, then kneel on both knees. Though high-spirited, they stay in formation and stamp with 1,000 hooves. With bent knees and wine cups in their mouths and maintaining the rhythm, devotedly they make offerings for the sovereign's long life. These celestial thoroughbreds are amazing. Nimbly prancing, they keep in step with the music. High-spirited, they step together, never deviating." That poem captures a bit of the cosmopolitan, wealthy, maybe even ostentatious nature of the royal court, where you might encounter people and products and goods from all over the world. And all of this was used by the emperor and encouraged by him in order to provoke awe among his subjects, as well as to delight them. These foreign-bred horses were also employed in another context as part of another hugely popular foreign import. And this is one that came from Persia and is the sport of polo. Tang paintings show polo matches, and in these, sometimes women are shown playing right alongside the men. There are also ceramic figurines of elegant court ladies playing polo. And all of this captures the graceful movements, both of the women and the horses. Another reason for the popularity of polo among Chinese aristocrats is that the quality of your horse and the elaborateness of the trappings on it could function as a status symbol and a way that you could flaunt your wealth publicly. Along with horses, the Tang had a craze for flowers, especially peonies. Every year at the time of peony blossoming, hordes of carriages carrying China's elites would descend on certain places that were famous for their peony gardens. One of these was the Buddhist Temple of Mercy and Compassion, whose flowers consistently would open 2 weeks earlier than others. And various individuals would compete with one another to try to cultivate the most luxuriant blossoms, or to try and find plants that would produce unusual colors of blooms. There's one story that tells of a monk who had a peony tree that produced blossoms that apparently were some shade of red that no other flower was like. And a group who was envious of this tricked the monk away from his beloved plant, and then they stole it. But they did leave behind an offering of gold and tea in its place. In many ways, the intense passion of the Tang for their peonies calls to mind the later tulip mania that famously struck Holland in the 17th century. Such luxury hobbies were supported by a very vibrant economy. The Tang economy was one that was highly regulated. The government had monopolies on things like salt, liquor, and tea. And of course, it also controlled grain shipments from the Yangtze Valley to the capital. The government employed a licensing system to try to stop or curb illegal business practices. And the innovation of long-distance credit was fostered by all of this trade, especially in tea between southern and northern China. There were things that were sort of bills of exchange called flying money, which you could use to pay for various goods and products throughout China. As in previous eras, there were state-run public granaries, which would stockpile up excess grain in order to prevent famine in times of bad harvest. Tang scientists and inventors advanced technological knowledge, and they came up with a number of very clever devices. Two developments in particular can perhaps be connected to the intellectual and religious currents of the time. Some neo-Taoists devoted themselves to trying to find elixirs that would grant immortality. Now, of course, they never found this, But what it did do is it caused them to practice experiments in alchemy, which in turn led to scientific advances in what today we would call the field of chemistry. And some of these new chemical advances included the discovery of new medicines, new dyes, and even the invention of gunpowder. There was also a huge growth in the printing industry and in printing technology. So in the Han era, ink rubbings had been made on paper which was stretched across stone carvings. But by the 6th century AD, real block printing had been developed. And by the 9th century AD, woodblock printing was common in East Asia. And really, the motivation for this technology was the desire to mass produce Buddhist texts to give to religious believers, and also to produce lots of Confucian texts that the students could then study who wanted to take those exams. An invention that affected rice cultivation was a contraption called the dragon's backbone. And this consisted of a whole series of paddles along a chain, which was driven by two men pushing pedals. And this whole thing served as a water pump to transfer water among fields, and even to raise water from one level to another. And together with all the new canals being built, the resulting increase in rice production helped to feed many of the immigrants who were displaced from the north by nomadic invaders. It also allowed southern China to grow in population and just to prosper economically in general. Other technological innovations of the same period included developments in using a magnetized needle to identify north and south. And this, of course, is really a forerunner to the compass. And also, they began to use some coal as a heating fuel. In the fine arts, the early Tang period had a true cultural flowering, in which painting, poetry, and music all thrived. Famous painters, sculptors, and poets all lived at this time, and the arts were also avidly pursued by people we might call educated dilettantes. Scholars and government officials would spend their spare time painting landscape scenes or composing poetry. And those two arts merged together in the practice of calligraphy, which used an inked brush on a silk or paper scroll to render poems as beautiful to look at as they are to listen to. And literature was maybe stimulated by the development of papermaking and that invention of block printing. The Tang era is regarded as one of the most fruitful in terms, especially of poetry. Poetry was very popular among all classes of society, from the emperor all the way down to the average guy in the street. And the value placed upon poetry is reflected in the fact that they would hold annual literary festivals, which would give prizes to poets. And the sheer volume of poetry being written is suggested by one Tang-era anthology, which collected 49,000 poems by 2,300 different poets. Of all the thousands of known Tang-era poets, several are especially famous. And two of these, Du Fu and Li Bo, were actually good friends, but they were very different in both their demeanor and their subject matter. Du Fu was a socially conscious Confucian, and so he tended to write anti-war poems. And in his poems, he worries about things such as man's cruelty to man. For example, one of his poems laments, "When will men be satisfied with building a wall against the barbarians? When will the soldiers return to their native land? And still, the heart of Emperor Wu is beating for war." Li Bo, on the other hand, often struck a less serious note in his poems, many of which were composed under the influence of alcohol. For instance, one poem called The Joys of Wine, in which he writes, "Heaven, since heaven and earth love wine, I can love wine without shaming heaven. With three cups, I penetrate the great Tao. Take a whole jugful, and I and the world are one." his poetic persona could also be somewhat anti-authoritarian. He had many of the characteristics we might call idealistic or romantic, but sometimes also there's a melancholy tone. So following Taoism, he held that a person should try to keep the heart and mind of a child and to always remain carefree. According to legend, this romantic nature eventually led to his death. Once when he was drunk on a boat, he became enraptured with the moon's reflection on the water, and he leaned out too far gazing at it so that he fell in and drowned. And maybe this story originated in the fact that many of his best-known poems do feature the moon. So here's one example. Beside my bed, the bright moonbeams glimmer, almost like frost on the floor. Rising up, I gaze at the mountains, bathed in moonlight, and lying back, I think of my old home. While we know the names of famous painters from this time, very few examples of Tang painting have managed to survive, except for there's a few wall paintings in tombs. And the man who is considered to be the greatest painter of the era was often praised for the extreme realism of his work. There's stories, for example, of how his wall paintings were so lifelike that after finishing one, he could just walk into it and vanish. Well, unfortunately, we can't judge their quality for ourselves because none of these remain. The most common surviving Tang art object are the beautiful glazed pottery figurines that I've mentioned. And these are all often found in tombs. They sometimes depict fantastic creatures who would act as tomb guardians, as well as more ordinary things such as horses, camels, or various kinds of people, including foreigners. And in the depictions of foreigners in these potteries, they're so detailed that we can identify their ethnicity just from their clothing and features. It's interesting to note that while Chinese art on the whole emphasizes order and tradition, there's also room for deviation and experimentation. So one Tang artist is known to have shaken ink-saturated hair at silk, somewhat like a 7th century Jackson Pollock, and another artist would fling paint while dancing. All across the arts, this kind of desire for spontaneity and naturalness seems to have unleashed a torrent of artistic self-expression. And again, poetry in particular was considered the best way to express yourself and to embody emotion. One popular poetic convention of this time was to adopt in a poem the persona of a complicated individual who is troubled by strong but contradictory emotions. A typical attitude of the followers of this movement are expressed by one poet who states, "Since youth, I have not fit into the common mold. It's folly to follow propriety and conventions too earnestly." In another poem called Drinking Alone in the Rainy Season, he further explains, "I try a cup, and all my concerns become remote. Another cup, and suddenly I forget even heaven. But is heaven really so far from this state? Nothing is better than to trust your true self." While some poets gave themselves up to indulgence in physical pleasures and fine living, others believed that artistic creation and physical suffering had to go hand in hand. So one of these poets proclaimed, "The poet suffers making poems, and poets are usually pure and rugged. They die from hunger, clinging to desolate mountains." The common thread that links all of these disparate artists together is the intensity of their passion for their creative activity, whatever the accompanying lifestyle might be. Very much like the flowers of which they were so fond, Tang culture blossomed beautifully for a brief moment and then was no more. But the memory of its glory has persisted, and it continues to be a yardstick against which other eras of Chinese history are measured. Thank you.